Okay, so as we pick up in, we'll be picking up in chapter 8 in just a minute, thinking through the book and the argument that the Hebrew writer's been making. Alan's already sort of refreshed our memory as to the purpose of the argument. Being so that they wouldn't shrink back, and we might think about the book of Hebrews pointing out the fact that redemptive history is in fact a one-way street, and what the Christians that the Hebrew writer is writing to are thinking about is they're thinking about turning around on a one-way street. And of course, that generally doesn't work out too well if you're going the wrong way down a one-way street. And so every step of God's redemptive plan is moving us closer to Him, and everything in the Old Testament is moving us down the road toward Jesus Christ. And so it's always from the lesser to the greater. And that's why I tell them, don't turn around. Because you're, number one, you're moving away from God. And number two, you're going back to that which is less, as opposed to moving the way the whole direction of redemptive history is moving. And so there was a law that was delivered through prophets and through ultimately through angels. But that's pointing to something greater. That's pointing to a message that would be delivered not through angels, but through the Son of God, the great King. There is the promise of a rest in the Old Testament, but that rest pointed toward something greater. And the people in Moses' time missed that because of a lack of faith. But even Joshua didn't give them the ultimate rest. He brought them into a rest that only pointed to a greater rest that comes through Jesus Christ. And likewise, the priesthood, the Levitical priesthood, was the means God had established for men to connect with Him, but it points toward a greater priesthood and a greater connection, a greater intimacy. And that's the argument that He has, in fact, been making. And he has argued in the latter half of chapter, or the latter couple of verses of chapter 4 and into 5, that Jesus has passed through the heavens. He didn't enter into an earthly tabernacle, but he's gone into the very presence of God. He is sympathetic to our weaknesses. But the old priests were sympathetic to our weaknesses. But why were they sympathetic? Right, because they were sympathetic because they had sinned. Jesus is sympathetic because he has undergone the same kinds of trials and difficulties we've gone through. But he's done that without sin. Jesus was appointed by God. He didn't take this priesthood upon himself. He made that argument from Psalm 2 and Psalm 110. And he learned obedience by the things he suffered. That is, he experienced what we in fact experience. And because of that, he is what they could never be. He is the source of eternal salvation. And then he takes them to task. Because these things are hard to explain because they've become dull of hearing. And he warns them against turning back, turning away. But he expresses confidence that they're not going to do that. He's convinced of better things concerning them, things concerning salvation. And then he re-engages this theme of the priesthood of Melchizedek. And we saw a couple of things with regard to Melchizedek that demonstrated Melchizedek's superiority to Abraham and therefore his superiority to Levi. And that is, Abraham paid tithes to Melchizedek, and therefore Levi, being in Abraham's loins, also paid tithes to Melchizedek. And Melchizedek blessed Abraham, and therefore he is greater than Abraham. And where there's a new priesthood, and this is going to become really important in our text, there's a new covenant. Why couldn't Jesus be a priest under the old law? He's not a Levite. That's right. He's from the tribe of Judah, a tribe concerning which Moses spoke nothing concerning priests. Jesus has become a priest based on the power of an indestructible life. So the priests had a really bad habit of, even the good priests had a bad habit of dying. But Jesus overcame death. And so, again, his priesthood is superior. Aaron became a priest based on the law, not based on an oath. Jesus became a priest through an oath. And the fact that the oath even arose is a demonstration that the Levitical priesthood was not sufficient, else Jesus wouldn't have come, or God wouldn't have come along afterwards and made this promise, promised that there would, in fact, be another priesthood according to the order of Melchizedek, as he, in fact, does through David in the 110th Psalm. And then he declares Jesus holy, innocent, undefiled, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens. And that sort of brings us up to chapter 8, and where he's kind of beginning to shift gears in 27 and 28, because he says, he points out in 27 that Jesus does not need daily, like those priests, to offer up sacrifices first for his own sins and then for the sins of the people. And so he's been comparing Jesus to Melchizedek previous to this, but now he's established that the priesthood according to the order of Melchizedek is superior to the Levitical priesthood, but now he kind of drops Melchizedek, not absolutely, but he falls into the background of the argument, because one of the things that we never see Melchizedek do is offer sacrifices. There's no record of Melchizedek sacrificing. I suppose he did, but we don't have any record of that. And so he's got to talk about the sacrifice of Jesus and how it is superior. And so he's going to revert to a discussion of the contrast between Jesus as a priest after the order of Melchizedek and the Levitical priest. And so, again, Melchizedek is not gone, but he sort of fades into the background for this part of the argument. And then the point of comparison is with the Levitical priesthood in general. And when we get to chapter 9, specifically the Day of Atonement, which is his sort of touchstone in this argument about sacrifice is the Day of Atonement. And I think it'll become evident why he focuses in on that when we go back and we spend a little bit of time looking at Leviticus 16 and thinking about the nature of the Day of Atonement. So he says, here in Hebrews 8, 1 and 2. Now, the main point in what has been said is this. We have such a high priest who has taken his seat at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens. Now, he's still going to be talking about Jesus taking his seat all the way over in chapter 10. So that idea is very, very important. It speaks to a number of things, not the least of which is that his work is completed. But right now, he zooms in on the fact that he's a minister in the sanctuary and in the true tabernacle, which the Lord pitched, and not man. And so we have a couple of tabernacles. We have the tabernacle that man pitched, that's talked about in at least the conclusion of that, is mentioned in Exodus 40:33, where it talks about the fact that Moses completed the tabernacle. That was a tabernacle made with hands, made with human hands. We'll look at that a little bit more in just a moment. But that's not the tabernacle that Jesus entered into. Jesus entered into a heavenly tabernacle, the true tabernacle, the actual presence of God. And then he says in verse 3, every high priest is appointed to offer both gifts and sacrifices. So it is necessary that this high priest also have something to offer. So he's got to have a sacrifice. A priest has got to have a sacrifice, right? That's what priests do. They offer sacrifices. We'll talk about why in just a minute. And so he says, if he were here on earth, he would not be a priest at all, since there are those who offer the gifts according to the law. And so that's going back to something that he had said previously in chapter 7, that when the priesthood is changed in verse 12 of necessity, chapter 7, verse 12, of necessity there is a change of the law also. Jesus can't operate under the law. That there are other priests who are doing that. And so he's setting up this idea of a new law, a new covenant, but we're not there yet. They serve a copy and a shadow of the heavenly things, just as Moses was warned when he was about to erect the tabernacle. For see, he says, that you make all things according to the pattern. Now that's a quotation from Exodus 25, 40. Where, and what's happening in Exodus 25? Anybody remember what that is the beginning of? It'll be a long night. That is the beginning. Exodus 25 is the beginning of the tabernacle instructions. The tabernacle instructions go from Exodus 25 through 31, and then there's the sort of the golden calf incident in Exodus 32 through 34, and then in 35 through 40, they actually build the tabernacle, which repeats much of what is said in Exodus 25 through 31. But in Exodus 25, they take up a contribution, and he begins to give them instructions about the Ark of the Covenant, about the table of showbread and the golden lampstand. And he makes this remark that the Hebrew writer quotes in verse 40. He says, see that you make them after the pattern for them which was shown you on the mountain. So he says, make sure that the Ark of the Covenant that's in the tabernacle looks like the Ark of the Covenant that you saw on the mountain. And make sure that everything else, essentially, in the tabernacle looks like the pattern you saw on the mountain. Well, why? Why is this pattern important? Well, it's what God wanted, but why did God want it that way? Okay, to keep it as he would like it, but why does he like it that way? Okay, shadows and types, exactly. This pattern that was realized on earth as they constructed the tabernacle is the reflection of a greater spiritual reality. Okay? Notice verse 5 here. Verse 4 and 5. If he were on earth, he would not be a priest at all, since there are those who offer gifts according to the law. He's talking about the priests. They offer gifts according to the law, who serve a copy and shadow of what? The heavenly things. And so this is a copy and shadow of a heavenly reality. Okay? Now, I'm not suggesting that heaven looks like this, okay? I don't think that's the point. But there are heavenly realities that are conveyed in this. Now, what I'm about to say is not the Hebrew writer's main point. But since this is a sermon, and since he makes practical applications, I'm going to spin off and make some practical applications of my own. I'm going to take a little bit of liberty with his argument here and make some important practical applications. It's not something we haven't said before. But when God says a thing, or when God reveals a thing, it's not arbitrary ever. Because God is not arbitrary. I hear people suggest all the time that, yeah, well, that, you know, that's just the, God did it. He could have done it some other way. Well, let me ask, could God have done this some other way? No, because some other way would not have been a copy and shadow of the heavenly things. He couldn't have just mixed it up however he wanted to, because it would not have adequately reflected who he is and what is necessary to approach him. This is the way it is because it had to be. Okay, so just like you remember Jesus' prayer in the garden, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Did the cup pass from him? Why not? Because it wasn't possible. It was necessary. His death on the cross was necessary. It was necessary because of who God is. God can't just overlook sin. It doesn't work that way. And so this copy of the heavenly things, this shadow of the heavenly things, is the way it is because it had to be that way. And we can see a couple of things that are pretty significant themes in the book of Hebrews by looking at this. So what is, if you're coming from the east, and you are coming from the east because that's the direction you would come from as you came to the tabernacle, because that's where the gate is. And that's always the orientation of the... That was the orientation of the garden. It's the orientation of the tabernacle. It's the orientation of the temple. It's the orientation of Ezekiel's temple. So you're coming from the east into the courtyard of the tabernacle. What's the first thing you come to? This is an open overhead test. Actually, I'm just finding which of you have really good eyesight. Those of you who can't read that, I will be trying to get out of the parking lot before you tonight. What's the first thing you come to? The altar. Okay? Which right away suggests that you can't come into the presence of God apart from what? Sacrifice. We'll talk about why in a minute. I think it'll become evident. And then what's next? The labor. What was the labor? Right. It's essentially a wash basin. And so the first two things that they would encounter, the wash basin was for the priest. But if you're going to come into the presence of God, there's got to be sacrifice and there's got to be cleansing. Now, you don't need a PhD in Leviticus to figure that out. You just look at the picture. Because the presence of God is at the Ark of the Covenant. And so you see, as you move through this thing, you learn things about God. That's reflective of spiritual realities. And we're going to see that a major concern of the Hebrew writer is sacrifice and cleansing, and the necessity for sacrifice and for cleansing, and what all is entailed in that. But that's seen in the structure of the tabernacle, because the structure of the tabernacle is what it is because it is a reflection of heavenly spiritual realities. And the other point I would make along those lines is, this is another reason we shouldn't mess with God's pattern. Because we do not know, we have no idea what the implications of a change might be. But almost inevitably, it is going to lead to false conclusions about the nature and character of God, and that's bad. And so we need to honor God's pattern in general. Again, not his main point, but these things are made according to the pattern. Now, he continues on to talk about this, and he says, but now he has obtained a more excellent ministry by as much as he is the mediator of a better covenant. Now, he goes back to that idea that we talked about in Hebrews 7:12 again, and he says, of necessity, the priesthood changes. What else changes? Hebrews 7:12. Priesthood changes, and there is of necessity a change of the law. Exactly so. And so he begins to talk about the change of the law. And he quotes Jeremiah 31:31-34. He said, if that first covenant had been faultless, there would have been no occasion sought for a second. And he points to another promise of God. For finding fault with them, he says, behold, days are coming, says the Lord, when I will effect a new covenant. So as soon as he says new covenant, that makes the old covenant old. And you know that there's a need. The only reason he would talk about a new covenant, is there something wrong with the old covenant? Now, let's go back to Jeremiah. Jeremiah actually tells us what's wrong with the old covenant. In Jeremiah 31:31-34, he says, behold, days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel, with the house of Judah, not like the covenant which I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to bring them out of Egypt. And then he tells us what's wrong with the old covenant. And what is it? What's wrong with the old covenant? They broke it. The old covenant was broken. Who broke it? Yeah, God's people broke it. That's what's wrong with it. And it's important. It's important that we understand that. God is coming around with a new covenant because the old covenant was broken. It was violated. And it was, they didn't sort of crack it a little bit. They broke it big time. Because, of course, the old covenant had provisions within it that, if you sinned, there were sacrifices that could be offered. And I understand the blood of bulls and goats doesn't take away sins. I get all that. But I want to make a point about the breaking of the covenant for a moment. That aside, for the time being. They didn't even, it's not that they said, uh-oh, we violated the covenant. Now we better look at the covenant carefully and make sure we do the things that the covenant calls for that we should do when we do violate the covenant, when we do sin. That's not what happened. They violated the covenant when they were confronted with the idea that they violated the covenant and told what they needed to do according to the covenant. They said, we're not doing that either. And so when they found out they broke the covenant, then they jumped up and down on it. And so it was a high-handed, willful violation of the covenant. They broke it not a little. Now, I'm not suggesting that a new covenant wouldn't have been necessary if they'd only broken it a little, but I want us to see that a little breaking of the covenant was not the problem. It was a high-handed rebellion against God, a willful violation of His covenant. And so God's response to this willful violation of the covenant, according to Jeremiah, is to do what? Make a new covenant. Well, you know, think about that a minute. All right? So, your son graduates from high school, and you buy him a 2018 Honda Accord. And you say, here's a car for you. And he takes the new car out and he wrecks it, and you find out it wasn't an accident, he did it on purpose. He just smashed his car up on purpose. And so you come back around and you say, all right, well, if that's what you're going to do, then no more Honda Accord. From now on, you're going to have to drive around in a Rolls-Royce Corniche convertible. Now, I'm guessing not very many parents would respond that way. But that doesn't even begin to touch what God did, because the Rolls-Royce Corniche convertible is not enough nicer than the Honda Accord to bridge the gap between the Old Covenant and what we have in Jesus Christ. As great as the Old Covenant was, and it wasn't bad, that's not the point. The failure was in the people. But God says, I'm going to do something so much better for you. And then He begins to describe the nature of this covenant. He says, it's not like the covenant which I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, my covenant which they broke, although I was a husband to them. Now, which part of that description is bad? Okay, He took them by the hand and He led them out of Egypt. That was a terrible thing to do, wasn't it? Deliver them from their bondage and lead them up into the promised land? Just unmitigated meanness, right? No, it's a tremendous blessing. He says, it's not like that. Far, far greater. They broke that covenant. But this is the covenant I will make with the house of Israel after these days. I will put my law within them, and on their heart I will write it. I will be their God, and they shall be my people. And so this covenant is going to be unprecedented in the intimacy of the relationship. And that's where that whole tabernacle thing becomes important, because is Jesus ultimately leading us into a copy or shadow of heaven? Is that where we're going? Everybody hope to go to a copy or shadow of heaven? that nobody? I can't get any takers on that? We're going to the real one. Right? We're going into the actual presence of God. Okay? And so, and everything that that entails, and of course, the first thing that entails is us being made fit to go into the actual one, which is where the writing of the law on our hearts and minds comes in. But that's what's on. So something far greater. That was a picture. This is the reality. And so, and you know what it's like. You go someplace like Red River Gorge and you get your phone out and you take a picture and you send it to somebody and they say, meh. But it doesn't, it's not, it's just not. You can't. There's no way. Even if you got that, you know, that neat Apple panorama thing, you still, it's not, you just can't. There's no substitute for being there. Well, this 100-fold what that is. And so Jesus makes this better covenant, this greater covenant possible. And that's what he came to do. And so the Hebrew writer quotes this and then he comments on it, this new covenant. I'm getting ahead of myself here. He says, when he said a new covenant, he made the first obsolete. But whatever is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to disappear. Now, why is he emphasizing the fact that the old covenant is ready to disappear? Why is that relevant to his readers? Right. Okay, that's come to an end. In their situation, though, and given where their heads are, why is this particularly important to their audience? Okay, people are going, they're being tempted to go back to that, and the Hebrew writer is saying, listen, that ship sailed. You're going back to something that isn't a thing anymore. As soon as God said new covenant, the old one became old, and it's about to disappear. And so you're thinking about going back to something you can't go back to because there's no there anymore. All right, so that's gone. That's gone. It's no more. And so it would be like us, you know, I want to go back to Babylon and I want to look at the Ishtar Gate and I want to, well, yeah, that's not there anymore. Babylon fell. I don't know if you all got the news. Everybody knew that, right? It's not there anymore. It's gone. And so, there's not. You can't go visit the Hanging Gardens. Sorry, that's all gone. There are, I suppose, archaeological remnants, but the city's gone. It's no more. And he's saying, it's growing old. It's ready to disappear. You can't go back to that. And then he begins to revisit the Levitical priesthood in chapter 9 and make this comparison. But we need to look at, before we dive into this, we need to think about the Day of Atonement. And we'll come back and we'll review some of this next time. But let's sort of think through Leviticus for a minute. Because I know you all have been reading Leviticus habitually, because that's what Christians do, especially modern Christians. But there's a sort of a progression to Leviticus. The first seven chapters deal with sacrificial laws. And then in 8 through 10, you have the dedication of the priesthood. And then 11 through 15, you have laws about purity. And you have, in chapter 11, the first thing you come across is the food laws. Okay, and you have all kinds of laws about all kinds of things that are just fascinating to read about, like bodily emissions and all that sort of thing. But there are all of these things in 11 through 15 that can make you unclean. Okay, so clearly the book of Leviticus leaves us with the impression that it's not easy, it's not difficult to become unclean. Well, what happens when uncleanness comes into the presence of God? Well, first of all, if you're unclean, you're not allowed to go up to the tabernacle. But obviously, by the very fact that God is having coming into close contact with men, we know that uncleanness is eventually going to come up into the tabernacle. And so, what's the solution for that? How do we fix this problem of all these unclean people coming up in close proximity to God? Well, that's what Leviticus 16 is about. That's the next thing in Leviticus, is the Day of Atonement. It is the sort of solution to all the problems that are implied in Leviticus 11 through 15. You've got Leviticus 16, the Day of Atonement. And the Day of Atonement is going to be the thing that fixes this. And one of the first things we're told, this comes up a couple times, verse 6, and I think later on in 11 or 16, this is repeated. It says, then Aaron shall offer the bull for the sin offering, which is for himself. Okay, there's an idea that the Hebrew writer has already brought up quite a bit. And so the first sacrifice on the Day of Atonement that the priest offers is a sacrifice for his own sins. And this is in keeping with earlier statements made in the latter part of that 1 through 7 section about what to do about the sins of the people and the leaders. Aaron is to offer a bull for a sin offering, which is for himself. And then he shall make atonement for the holy place because of the impurities of the sons of Israel and because of their transgressions in regard to all their sins. And so the Day of Atonement is specifically about cleansing the environs of the tabernacle of all the sins and impurities that had accumulated over the year because of the people coming up there. Because the tabernacle would have been holy and pure and clean if no people had gone up there. But you got people going up in there. And they're bringing in their impurities, which is just a way of God teaching us that we're not worthy to come into His presence. And then toward the end of this, he says in verse 34, he says, now you shall have this as a permanent statute to make atonement for the sons of Israel and for all their sins once every year, Leviticus 16:34. We'll talk about some other aspects of the Day of Atonement as we sort of get into chapter 9, and we'll go back to the structure of the tabernacle as we get into chapter 9 and look at how all of this unfolded. But this once a year statement is really important. The Hebrew writer is going to make much of that. Because what does it indicate that they had to do this over and over and over and over again? Yeah, it indicates sin. What does it indicate about sin? It's not taken care of. That's the point. So how many times would they have had the Day of Atonement if the sacrifices offered on the Day of Atonement had really been effective? How many days of atonement would there have been? One. Okay? But there's not one. It's not one by design. It's annual, which is, again, the Hebrew writer will say, a reminder year after year that man is not worthy to come into the presence of God. He is still in his sins. And so that necessarily tells us that the bull that was offered for the sins of the priest and the goat that was offered for the sins of the people, those are the... He doesn't... When he says in Hebrews 10, the blood of bulls and goats, he says bulls and goats because those are the sacrifices specific to the Day of Atonement. That's the discussion all the way through. He doesn't just sort of pull those randomly out of the sacrificial system or not say lambs or something else. He mentions specifically the bull and the goat because the Day of Atonement is sort of the umbrella over this whole section here. It's emblematic of other things too, but he didn't sort of pick those randomly. They're picked specifically because of their connection to the Day of Atonement. And he's pointing out that manifestly, by looking at Leviticus, we can see that didn't solve the problem. And so that's not the solution. That is not going to make it possible for you to come into the presence of God. So if you're thinking about going back to that, it ain't going to work. It ain't going to work. I think that was the second bell. So we will pick up and begin to look at chapter 9. Please go read at least Leviticus 16. If you're not going to read the whole book, at least read Leviticus 16 a couple dozen times between now and next time. And sort of Hebrews 8 through 10 so that we can have more give and take. Thank you.